May I, monsieur, offer my services without running the risk of intruding? I fear you may not be able to make yourself understood by the worthy gorilla who presides over the fate of this establishment. In fact, he speaks nothing but Dutch. Unless you authorize me to plead your case, he'll not guess that you want gin. There, I dare hope he understood me. That nod must mean that he yields to my arguments. And now I shall withdraw, monsieur, happy to have been of help to you. Oh, thank you. Thank you. I'd accept if I were sure of not being a nuisance. Oh, you're too kind. Then I shall bring my glass over beside yours. You're right, his dumbness is deafening. His business consists in entertaining sailors of all nationalities in this Amsterdam bar, which he happens to have known, no one knows why. The Mexico City. Our host, as a result of not understanding what's said in his presence, has taken on a distrustful character. Hence, that look of touchy dignity, as if he suspected at least that all is not perfect among men, which makes it difficult to discuss anything with him which doesn't concern his business. Notice, for instance, on the back wall above his head, that empty rectangle marking the place where a picture's been taken down. Indeed, there was a picture there. A particularly interesting one. A real masterpiece. Well, I was present when the master of the house received it, and when he parted with it. In both cases, he did so after weeks of rumination and with the same distrust. Mind you, I'm not judging him. I consider his distrust justified and would be inclined to share it if, as you see, my communicative nature were not opposed to this. I'm talkative, alas, and make friends easily. When I used to live in France, were I to meet an intelligent man, I immediately sought his company. Why, yes, let's have another gin. Are you staying long in Amsterdam? Beautiful city, isn't it? Well, fascinating. There's an adjective I haven't heard for some time, not since leaving Paris, in fact, years ago. But the heart has its own memory. And I've forgotten nothing of our beautiful capital. Its keys. Paris is a real trompe-l'œil, a magnificent dummy setting inhabited by 4 million silhouettes. Nearly 5 million at the last census. Well, they must have multiplied. And that wouldn't surprise me. It's always seemed to me that our fellow citizens have two passions, ideas and fornication, without rhyme or reason, so to speak. Dear, let's take care not to condemn them. They're not the only ones. All Europe's in the same boat. I sometimes think of what future historians will say of us. A single sentence will suffice for modern man. He fornicated and he read the papers. After that vigorous definition, the subject will be, if I may say so, exhausted. Oh, no, not the Dutch. They are much less modern. They have time. Why, just look at them. Ah, here's our gin at last. To your prosperity. Yes, the gorilla opened his mouth to call me doctor. I'm not a doctor, if you want to know. I was a lawyer before coming here. Now, I am a judge penitent. Ah, but allow me to introduce myself. Jean-Baptiste Clemence, at your service. Pleased to know you. You're in business, no doubt, in a way. Oh, excellent reply. Oh, judicious, too. In all things, we are merely in a way. Now, allow me to play the detective. You're my age, in a way, with the sophisticated eye of a man in his 40s who's seen everything, in a way. You're well-dressed, in a way. That is, as people are in our country. And your hands are smooth. Hence a bourgeois, in a way, but a cultured bourgeois. Decidedly, you interest me. As for me, well, judge for yourself. By my stature, my shoulders, and this face that I've often been told was shy, I look rather like a football player, don't I? But if I'm judged by my conversation, it must be allowed I have a little subtlety. I, too, am sophisticated. And yet I confide in you without caution on the sole basis of your looks. Finally, despite my good manners and my fine speech, I frequent sailors' bars on the Zeedijk. My profession is double, that's all. Just like the human being. I've told you, I'm a judge penitent. Only one thing is simple in my case. I possess nothing. Yes, I was rich. No, I shared nothing with the poor. Well, what does that prove? That I, too, was a sad, you see. Ah. Do you hear the foghorns in the harbour? Be fogged tonight on the Zuider Zee. Are you leaving already? Oh, forgive me for having perhaps detained you. No, I beg you. I won't let you pay. You're a chamois to Mexico City. It's given me great pleasure to receive you here. Yeah, send to be here tomorrow, as I am every evening, and I should be glad to accept your invitation. Well, your way back? Well, if you don't have any objection, the easiest thing would be for me to accompany you as far as the harbour. Thence, by going round the Jewish quarter, you'll come to those handsome avenues with the trams loaded with flowers and noisy with thunder trooping down them. Your hotel's on one of them, the Damrak. Yeah, you first.
These? I live in the Jewish quarter, or what was called so, until our Hitlerian brethren spaced it out of it. What a clean-up.
75,000 Jews deported or assassinated. That's real vacuum cleaning. I admire that diligence, that methodical patience. When one has no character, one has to apply a method. Here it did wonders, no one can deny it, and I'm living on the site of one of the greatest crimes in history. Well, perhaps that's what helps me to understand the gorilla and his mistrustfulness.
All these people, eh? Out so late, despite the rain which hasn't let up the days.
I like walking through the city of an evening in the warmth of gin. I walk for nights on end. I dream. I'll talk to myself. Interminably. This country inspires me. I like this crowd of people swarming on the pavements, wedged into a little space of houses and canals, hemmed in by fogs, cold lands, and the sea steaming like wet washing. I like it, but it is double. It is here and elsewhere. But I'm letting myself go. I'm pleading a case, forgive me. Habit, monsieur, vocation. Also, the desire to make you fully understand this city and the heart of things. For we are at the heart of things here. Have you noticed that Amsterdam's concentric canals resemble the circles of hell? The middle-class hell, of course, people with bad dreams. When one comes from the outside, as one gradually goes through those circles, life, and hence its crimes, become denser, darker. Here, we're in the last circle. The circle of the... Oh, you know that? Why haven't you become harder to classify? In any case, the newspaper readers and the fornicators could go no further. They come from the four corners of Europe and stop, facing the inland sea on the drab strand. They listen to the foghorns, vainly trying to make out the silhouettes of boats in the fog. They turn back over the canals and go home through the rain. Chilled to the bone, they come and ask in all languages for gin at the Mexico City. Yeah. That's where I wait for them. Till tomorrow, then, monsieur et cher compatriot. Now, you'll easily find your way now. I'll leave you near this bridge. Yeah, no, I never cross a bridge at night. It's because of a vow.
Suppose, after all, that someone should jump in the water. One of two things, either you follow suit and fish him out, and in cold weather that's taking a great risk, or you forsake him there. And to suppress a dive sometimes leaves one strangely aching. Good night. What? Oh, those ladies behind those windows. Dream, monsieur. Cheap dream. Trip to the Indies. Those persons perfume themselves with spices. You go in, they draw the curtains, and the navigation begins. The gods come down onto the naked bodies, and the islands are set adrift. Lost souls crowned with the tousled hair of palm trees in the wind. Try it. Judge Penitent, you want to know what it is? I intrigued you with that little matter yesterday. Well, in a manner of speaking, it's really one of my official duties. A few years ago, I was a lawyer in Paris, and indeed a rather well-known lawyer. Of course, I didn't tell you my real name. I used to specialize in noble cases, the widow and the orphan, as the saying goes. I don't know why, because there are widows who cheat and orphans who are quite savage. And yet the slightest sniff of victimization was enough for me to swing into action. And what action? War, a real tempest. My heart was on my sleeve. You really might have thought that justice slept with me every night. I was buoyed up by two sincere feelings. The satisfaction of being on the right side of the bar, and an instinctive scorn for judges in general. That scorn, after all, perhaps wasn't quite so instinctive. I know now that it had its reasons. It can't be denied that, for the time being at least, we have to have judges, don't we? The feeling of the law, the satisfaction of being right, the joy of self-esteem, cher monsieur, are powerful incentives to uphold us and make us move forward. But on the other hand, if you deprive men of them, you transform them into dogs, frothing with rage. How many crimes committed merely because their authors couldn't endure being wrong? I enjoyed my own nature to the fullest, and we all know that therein lies happiness, although to soothe one another mutually, we occasionally pretend to condemn such joys as selfishness. At least I enjoyed that part of my nature which reacted so appropriately to the widow and the orphan that eventually, through exercise, it came to dominate my whole life. For instance, I loved to help blind people across streets. In the same way, I always enjoyed telling people the way in the street, giving a light, lending a hand with heavy barrows, pushing a stranded car, buying a paper from the Salvation Army girl, or flowers from the old woman peddler, although I knew she stole them from the Montparnasse Cemetery. I also liked, and this is harder to say, I liked to give alms, but let's say no more about that. Let us rather speak of my courtesy. It was famous and yet beyond question. If I had the luck on certain mornings to give up my seat in the bus or underground to someone who obviously deserved it, to pick up some object an old lady had dropped and return it to her with the smile I knew so well, or merely to forfeit my taxi to someone in a greater hurry than I, it was a red-letter day. These were all deeds I was able to perform because I paid more attention to the opportunities than others did and had more relish for the pleasures they gave. Consequently, I was considered generous, and so I was. I gave a great deal in public and in private, but far from suffering when I had to part with an object or a sum of money, I derived
constant pleasures from this. Among them, a sort of melancholy which occasionally rose within me at the thought of the sterility of these gifts and the probable ingratitude that would follow. These are just little touches, but they'll help you to grasp the constant delights I experienced in my life, and especially in my profession. Believe me, cher monsieur, this is achieving more than the vulgar ambitious man, and rising to that supreme summit where virtue is its own reward. Let's pause on these heights. Now you understand what I meant when I spoke of aiming higher. I was talking of those supreme summits, the only places where I can really live. Yes, I've never felt comfortable except in lofty surroundings. Even in the details of my daily life, I needed to feel above. I preferred the bus to the underground, open carriages to taxis, terraces to being indoors. Whilst on boats, I was the eternal pacer on the top deck. In the mountains, I used to flee the deep valleys. I was the man of the uplands. My profession satisfied most happily that vocation for summits. It cleansed me of all bitterness towards my neighbour, whom I always obliged without ever owing him anything. It set me above the judge whom I judged in turn, above the defendant whom I forced to gratitude. Just consider this, cher monsieur. I lived with impunity. I was concerned in no judgment. I was not on the floor of the courtroom, but somewhere in the flies, like those gods that are brought down by machinery from time to time to transfigure the action, give it its meaning. After all, living aloft is still the only way of being seen and hailed by the greatest number. The judges punished, and the defendants expiated, while I, free of any duty, shielded equally from judgment as from penalty, I freely held sway, bathed in a light as of Eden. You will readily see how I can speak without immodesty of a successful life. Yes, yes. Few creatures were more natural than I. I was altogether in harmony with life, fitting into it from top to bottom without rejecting any of its ironies, its grandeur, or its servitude. In particular, the flesh, the physical, which disconcerts or discourages so many men in love or in solitude without enslaving me, brought me steady joys. I was made to have a body. Whence that harmony in me, that relaxed mastery that people felt, even to telling me sometimes that it helped them in life? I was of respectable but humble birth. My father was an officer. And yet on certain mornings, let me confess it humbly, I felt like a king's son or a burning bush. Personally marked out among all for that long and uninterrupted success. This, after all, was the result of my modesty. When I add that I had no religion, you can see even better how extraordinary that conviction was. Whether ordinary or not, it served for some time to raise me above the daily routine, and I literally soared for a period of years, for which, to tell the truth, I still long in my heart of hearts. I soared until the evening when... that's another matter. It must be forgotten. Anyway, perhaps I'm exaggerating. I was at ease with everything, to be sure, but at the same time, satisfied with nothing. Each joy made me desire another. I went from festivity to festivity. On occasion, I danced for nights on end, ever madder about life and people. At times, late on those nights when the dancing, the slight intoxication, my wild enthusiasm, everyone's violent unrestraint would fill me with a tired and overwhelmed rapture. It would seem to me at the breaking point of fatigue and for a second's flash that at last I understood the secret of creatures and of the world. But the next day, fatigue would disappear and with it the secret. I would rush forth anew. I ran on like that, always heaped with favours, never sated, without knowing where to stop, and until the day, until the evening, rather, when the music stopped and the lights went out. The gay party at which I had been so happy. But allow me to call on our friend the primate. Nod your head, thank him, and above all, drink up with me. I need your understanding. I see that this declaration amazes you. Have you never suddenly needed understanding, help, friendship? Yes, of course. I've learnt to be satisfied with understanding. It's found more readily, and besides, it's not binding. What? Well, what evening? Oh, I'll get to it. Be patient with me. I've heard of a man whose friend had been imprisoned and who slept on the floor of his room every night in order not to enjoy a comfort of which his friend had been deprived. Who, cher monsieur, will sleep on the floor for me? Am I capable of it myself? Look, I'd like to be, and I shall be. Yes, we shall all be capable of it one day, and that would be salvation. But it's not easy. Maybe we don't love life enough. Have you noticed that death alone awakes our feelings, how we love the friends who've just left us? It's the recently dead we love among our friends. The painful dead, our emotion, ourselves, after all. That's the way man is, cher monsieur. He's two faces. He can't love without self-love. Now, notice your neighbours if perchance a death takes place in the building. They were all asleep in their little routine, and suddenly, for example, the concierge dies. At once they awake, bestir themselves, get the details, commiserate a newly dead man, and the show begins at last. They need tragedy, don't you know? It's their little transcendence, their aperitif. Something must happen. Even loveless slavery. Even war or death. Hurrah, then, for funerals. But I, at least, don't have that excuse. I was not bored, because I was riding on the crest of a wave. On the evening I'm speaking about, I can say that I was even less bored than usual. But yet, you see, cher monsieur, it was a fine autumn evening, still warm in town and already damp over the Seine. Night was falling, the sky still bright in the west was darkening, the street lamps were glowing dimly. I was walking up the quays of the left bank towards the Pont des Arts. I was happy. I'd gone up onto the Pont des Arts, deserted at that hour, to look at the river that could hardly be made out now that night had come. I felt within me, rising, a vast feeling of power. And I don't know how to express it, of completion, which cheered my heart. I straightened up and was about to light a cigarette, the cigarette of satisfaction, when, at that very moment, a laugh burst out behind me. Taken by surprise, I suddenly wheeled round. There was no one there. I stepped to the railing. No barge or boat. I turned back towards the island and again heard the laughter behind me. A little farther off. As if it was going downstream, I stood there. Motionless. The sound of the laughter was decreasing. But I could still hear it distinctly behind me, coming from nowhere unless from the water. At the same time, I was aware of the rapid beating of my heart. Please don't misunderstand me. There was nothing mysterious about that laugh. It was a good, hearty, almost friendly laugh, which put everything properly in its place. Soon I could hear nothing more anyway. I returned to the quays, went up the Rue Dauphine, bought some cigarettes, which I didn't need. I was dazed and was breathing fast. What? Ah, oh, forgive me, I was thinking of something else. Yeah, I'll see you tomorrow again, probably. Tomorrow? Yes, that's right. No, I can't stay. Besides, I'm being called for a consultation by the brown bear you see over there. He's a decent fellow, to be sure, whom the police are meanly persecuting out of sheer perversity. Think he looks like a killer. Oh, rest assured that his actions conform to his looks. He burgles likewise, and you'll be surprised to learn that that caveman specializes in the art trade. In Holland, everyone is a specialist in paintings and in tulips. This one, with his modest look, is the author of the most famous theft of a painting. Which one? I may tell you one day. Don't be surprised at my knowledge. Although I am a judge penitent, I have my sideline here. I'm the legal counselor of these good people. If pimps and thieves were always sentenced, all decent people get to thinking that they themselves were completely innocent, cher monsieur. And in my opinion, all right, I'm coming. That's what must be avoided at all costs. Otherwise, everything would be just a joke. I'm indeed grateful to you for coming here again, for your curiosity. However, there's nothing extraordinary about my story. Since you're interested, I'll tell you that I thought a little about that laugh for a few days and then forgot it. Once in a great while, I seemed to hear it within me, but most of the time, without making any effort, I thought of other things. Yet I must admit that I ceased to walk along the Paris quays. Whenever I travelled along them in the car or bus, a sort of silence would descend on me. I was waiting, I believe, but I would cross the Seine, nothing would happen, and I would breathe again. I also had some trouble with my health about that time. Oh, nothing definite, dejection perhaps, a sort of difficulty in recovering my good spirits. It seemed to me that I was in a way unlearning what I'd never learned and yet knew so well, how to live. Yes, I think it was probably then that everything began. But this evening I don't feel quite up to the mark either. I'm not talking so well, seems to me. Probably the weather. The air is so heavy it weighs on one's chest. Would you object, mon cher compatriot, to going out and walking in the town a little? Yeah. Thank you. How beautiful the canals are this evening. I like the breath of stagnant waters, the smell of dead leaves soaking in the canal, and the funereal scent rising from the barges loaded with flowers. Yeah, charming house, isn't it? The two heads you see up there are the heads of Negro slaves. It's a shop sign. The house belonged to a slave dealer. They weren't squeamish in those days. They were self-assured. They announced, "You see, I'm a man of substance. I'm in the slave trade. I deal in black flesh." Can you imagine anyone today making it known publicly that such is his business? Oh,
What a scandal. Slavery, certainly not. We're against it. That we should be forced to have it in our homes or in our factories, well, that's natural. But boasting about it, oh, that's a limit. I'm well aware that one can't get along without dominating or being served. Every man needs slaves as he needs fresh air, commandings, breathing. You agree with me? Even the most destitute manage to breathe. The lowest man in the social scale still has his wife or his child. If he's unmarried, a dog. Power settles everything. And just between ourselves, slavery, preferably smiling, is therefore inevitable. But we must not admit it. Whoever can't do without having slaves calls them free men. As a matter of principle to begin with, and secondly, not to drive them to despair. We owe them their compensation, don't we? Consequently, no shop signs, and this one is shocking. Besides, if everyone told all, displayed his true profession and identity, we should know which way to turn. Just fancy visiting cards. Dupont, jittery philosopher, or Christian landowner, or adulterous humanist. Indeed, there's a wide choice, but it would be hell. Yes, hell must be like that. Streets filled with shop signs and no way of explaining oneself. One is classified once and for all. You, for instance, mon cher compatriot, stop and think what your sign would be. Eh, you're silent. Well, you'll tell me later on. I know mine in any case. A double face. A charming Janus. And above it, the motto of the house, don't rely on it. On my cards, Jean-Baptiste Clemence, play actor. Well, shortly after the evening I told you about, I discovered something. Whenever I left a blind man on the pavement to which I'd conveyed him, I used to touch my hat to him. Obviously the hat touching wasn't intended for him since he couldn't see it. To whom was it intended? To the public? After playing my part, I would take my bow. Not bad, eh? I have to admit it humbly, mon cher compatriot. I was always bursting with vanity. I is the refrain of my whole life, and it could be heard in everything I said. I lived from day to day without any other continuity than that of I, without thought for the morrow with women, without thought for the morrow in virtue or vice, each day for itself, just like dogs, and myself, every day, secure at my post. Thus I progressed on the surface of life, in the realm of words, as it were, never in reality. Why, it's raining again. Let's stop, shall we? Under that porch. Yeah, good. Let's sit down on this bench out of the rain. For centuries, pipe smokers have been watching the same rain falling on the same canal. What I have to tell you concerns a woman. To begin with, you must know that I've always succeeded with women without much effort. I don't say succeed in making them happy, or even succeed in making myself happy with them. No, simply succeed. I used to achieve my ends just about whenever I wanted. I was considered to have charm. You know, fancy that. Do you know what charm is? A way of getting the answer yes without having asked any clear question. My relationship with women was natural, free, and easy, as the saying goes. No guile in it, except that obvious guile which they look upon as homage. I loved them according to the hallowed expression, which amounts to saying that I never loved any of them. I'm not hard-hearted, far from it. Only my emotional impulses always turn toward me. My feelings of pity concern me. No, it's not true.
that I never loved. I conceived at least one great love in my life, of which I was always the object. Sensuality alone dominated my love life. I looked merely for objects of pleasure and conquest. Moreover, I was aided in this by my looks. Nature had been generous with me. In any case, my sensuality, to limit myself to it, was so real that even for a 10-minute adventure I would have disowned father and mother, even were I to regret it bitterly. Nay, especially for a 10-minute adventure, and even more so if I were sure it was to have no sequel. It hurts me to confess it, but I would have given 10 conversations with Einstein for a first meeting with a pretty chorus girl. It's true that at the 10th meeting I was longing for Einstein or a serious book. In short, I was never concerned with the major problems except in the interval between my little excesses. Hence I played the game. I knew they didn't like one to reveal one's purpose too quickly. First, there had to be conversation, fond attentions, as they say. I wasn't worried about speeches being a lawyer, nor about glances, having been an amateur actor during my military service. I often changed parts, but it was always the same play, and the essential part of it lay in the assertion, painful and resigned, that I was nothing, that it was not worth getting involved with me, that my life was elsewhere, not related to everyday happiness. A happiness, it may be, I should have preferred to anything, but they were, it was too late. As to the reasons behind this decisive lateness, I maintain secrecy, knowing that it's always better to go to bed with a mystery. In a way, moreover, I believe what I said. I was living my part. Some cry, love me, others don't love me, but a certain genus, the worst and most unhappy, cries, don't love me and be faithful to me. And then, one day you find yourself taking without really desiring. That's what happened eventually. And there's no point in telling you who she was, except that without really stirring me, she had attracted me by her passive, avid manner. Frankly, it was a shabby experience, as I should have expected, but I never had any complexes. Soon forgot a person I didn't see again. But a few weeks later, I learned that she had related my deficiencies to a third person. At once I felt as if I'd been somewhat deceived. She wasn't so passive as I thought, and she didn't lack judgment. Then I shrugged my shoulders, pretended to laugh. I even laughed outright. Clearly the incident was unimportant. Despite having shrugged my shoulders, what was my behaviour in fact? I saw that woman again a little later and did everything necessary to charm her and really take her back. It wasn't very difficult, for they don't like either to end on a failure. From that moment onwards, without really intending it, I began, in fact, to mortify her in every way. I would give her up and take her back, force her to give herself at inappropriate times and in inappropriate places, treat her so brutally in every respect that eventually I attached myself to her as I imagined the jailer is bound to his prisoner. And this kept up till the day when, in the violent disorder of painful and constrained pleasure, she paid a tribute aloud to what was enslaving her. That very day, I began to move away from her. I've forgotten her since. Yeah, I'll agree with you, though you politely haven't said a word, that adventure's not a very pretty one. Search your memory. Perhaps you'll find some similar story that you'll tell me later on. As for me, when that little matter came to mind, I again began to laugh. But it was another kind of laugh, rather like the one I had heard on the Pont des Arts. Ultimately, in that regrettable story, even more than in my other affairs, I'd been more outspoken than I thought. No man's a hypocrite in his pleasures. I read that. What did I think of myself, mon cher compatriote? On my own admission, I could live happily only on condition that all the individuals on the earth, or the greatest possible number, were turned towards me, eternally unattached, deprived of any separate existence, and ready to answer my call at any moment, doomed, in short, to sterility until the day I should deign to favour them. In short, for me to live happily, it was essential for the individuals I chose not to live at all. They must receive their life only at my bidding. Oh, I don't feel any self-satisfaction, believe me, in telling you this. Tell me, mon cher compatriote, doesn't shame sting a little? It does. Well, probably shame, then, or one of those silly emotions to do with honour. It seems to me, in any case, that that emotion has never left me since the adventure I found at the heart of my memory, which I can't any longer put off relating. Ah, look, the rain stopped. Yeah, be kind enough to walk home with me. I'm strangely tired. Not from having talked so much, but at the mere thought of what I still have to say. Ah, well, a few words will suffice to relate my essential discovery. So here goes. That particular night in November, 2 or 3 years before the evening when I thought I heard laughter behind me, I was returning to the left bank to my home by way of the Pont Royal. It was an hour past midnight. A fine rain was falling, drizzle rather, that scattered a few people on the street. I had just left a mistress who was surely already asleep. I was enjoying that walk, a little numbed, my body calmed and irrigated by a flow of blood rather like the falling rain. On the bridge, I passed behind a figure leaning over the railing and seeming to stare at the river. On closer view, I made out a slim young woman dressed in black. Between her dark hair and coat collar could be seen the back of her neck, cool and damp, which disturbed me. I'd already gone some 50 yards when I heard the sound. Despite the distance, dreadfully loud in the midnight silence, of a body striking the water. Almost at once I heard a cry, repeated several times, which was going downstream. Then it abruptly ceased. The silence that followed as the night suddenly stood still seemed interminable. I wanted to run and yet didn't move an inch. I was trembling, I believe, from cold and shock. I told myself that I had to be quick, and I felt an irresistible weakness steal over me. I've forgotten what I thought then, oh, too late, too far, or something of the sort. I was still listening as I stood, motionless. Then, slowly, in the rain, I went away. I told no one. Oh, here we are. Here's my house, my refuge. But tomorrow... Yes, if you wish. I'd like to take you to the island of Marken so that you can see the Zuider Zee. Let's meet at 11 at the Mexico City. What? Oh, the woman? Oh, I don't know. Really, I don't know. Next day and the days following, I didn't read the papers. Doll's village, isn't there? No shortage of quaintness here. But I didn't bring you to this island for quaintness, cher ami. Anyone can show you peasant headdresses, wooden shoes, and ornamented houses with fishermen smoking choice tobacco, surrounded by the smell of furniture polish. I'm one of the few people, on the other hand, who can show you what really matters here. Yeah, we're reaching the dike. We'll have to follow it to get as far as possible from these two charming houses. Now, please, let's sit down. Well, what do you think of it? Isn't it the most beautiful negative landscape? Just see, on the left, that pile of ashes they call a dune here. The grey dike on the left, the livid beach at our feet, and in front of us the sea of the vast sky reflecting the colourless waters. A flabby hell, indeed. Everything horizontal, no relief, space is colourless, and life dead. Is it not universal obliteration, everlasting nothingness made visible? No human beings. Above all, no human beings. You and I, alone, facing the planet, at last deserted. Haven't you noticed that the sky of Holland is filled with millions of doves, invisible because of their altitude, which flap their wings, rise or fall in unison, filling the heavenly space with dense multitudes of greyish feathers carried hither and thither by the wind. The doves wait up there all the year round. They wheel above the earth, look down, and would like to come down, but there's nothing but the sea and the canals, roofs covered with shop signs, never a head on which to alight. Well, you don't understand what I mean. Well, I grant you, I'm tired. I lose the thread of what I'm saying. I've lost that lucidity to which my friends used to enjoy paying respects. I say, my friends, moreover, as a matter of principle, I have no more friends. I have nothing but accomplices. And to make up for this, their number has increased. They are the whole human race. And within the human race, you, first of all, whoever is at hand, is always the first. How do I know I have no friends? Oh, it's very easy. I discovered it the day I thought of killing myself to play a trick on them, to punish them, in a way. But punish whom? Some would be surprised. No one would feel punished. Besides, let's not beat about the bush. I love life. That's my real weakness. I love it so much that I'm incapable of imagining what is not life. One dies if necessary. One breaks rather than bends. But I bend because I continue to love myself. For example, after all I've told you, what do you think I developed? An aversion for myself. It was mostly others that I was fed up with. The case against the others went on constantly in my heart. Yes, of course. What does that shock you? The question is how to elude judgment. I'm not saying to avoid punishment, for punishment without judgment is bearable. No, on the contrary, it is a matter of dodging judgment or avoiding being forever judged without ever having a sentence pronounced. But one can't dodge it so easily. Today we're always as ready to judge as we are to fornicate. If you doubt this, just listen to the table conversation during August in those summer hotels where our charitable fellow citizens take their cure for boredom. Or read the writings of our great men of the moment. Or else observe your own family. You'll learn a thing or two. Mon cher ami, let's not give them any pretext, no matter how small, for judging us. Otherwise, we'll be left in shreds. We are forced to take the same precautions as the lion tamer. If, before going into the cage, he has the misfortune to cut himself while shaving, what a feast for the animals. Yeah, I realized this all of a sudden the day I began to suspect that maybe I wasn't so admirable. From then on, I became mistrustful. Since I was bleeding slightly, there was no escape for me. They would devour me. My relations with my contemporaries were apparently the same. My friends hadn't changed. But the moment I grasped that there was something to judge in me, I realized that, in fact, they had an irresistible vocation for judgment. Once my attention was aroused, it was not hard for me to discover that I had enemies. In my profession to begin with, and also in my social life. The look of success when worn a certain way would infuriate a jackass. Your success and happiness are forgiven you only if you generously consent to share them. Consequently, there's no escape. Happy and judged, or absolved and wretched. People hasten to judge in order not to be judged themselves. Well, what do you expect? The idea that comes most naturally to man, as if from his very nature, is the idea of his innocence. From this point of view, we are all like that little Frenchman at Buchenwald who insisted on registering a complaint with the clerk, himself a prisoner, who was recording his arrival. A complaint? The clerk and his comrades laughed. Useless, old man, you don't lodge complaints here. But you see, said the little Frenchman, my case is exceptional. I am innocent. We are all exceptional cases. We all want to appeal against something. Each of us insists on being innocent at all costs, even if he has to accuse the whole human race and heaven itself. As I told you, it's a matter of dodging judgment. Since it is hard to dodge it, tricky to get one's nature simultaneously admired and excused, they all strive to be rich. Why? For power, of course, but especially because wealth shields from immediate judgment. Not quite acquittal, but reprieve. And it's always worth having. We should like, at the same time, to cease being guilty and yet not to make the effort of cleansing ourselves. We lack the energy required for evil as well as that required for good. Do you know Dante? Really? Well, I'll be damned. Then you'll know that Dante accepts the idea of neutral angels in the quarrel between God and Satan. And he puts them in limbo, a sort of vestibule of his hell. We are in the vestibule, cher ami. Patience? You're probably right. It'd take patience to wait for the last judgment, but there you are, we're in a hurry. So much in a hurry, indeed, that I was obliged to make myself a judge penitent. From the evening when I was called, for I really was called, I had to answer, or at least seek an answer. I lived my whole life under a double code. And my most serious acts were often the ones in which I was the least involved. Wasn't it this, after all, for which, on top of my blunders, I couldn't forgive myself, which made me revolt most violently against the judgment I felt forming in me and around me, and that forced me to seek an escape? For some time, in appearances, my life continued as if nothing had changed. I was on rails and speeding ahead. And it was at that moment the engine began to have whims, inexplicable breakdowns. Then it was that the thought of death burst into my daily life. And I was tormented by the thought that I might not have time to accomplish my task. But that was not quite it. A ridiculous fear pursued me, in fact. One could not die without having confessed all one's lies. Not to God or one of his representatives. I was above all that, as you can well imagine. No, it was a matter of confessing to men, to a friend, to a beloved woman, for example. Otherwise, even if there were only one lie hidden in a life, death made it definitive. That absolute murder of a truth used to make me dizzy. Today, by the way, it would cause me subtle joys. The idea, for instance,
that I am the only one to know that I have at home an object which has kept the police of three countries unsuccessfully on the run. It's a sheer delight. But let's not go into that. At the time, I had not yet found the recipe, and I was fretting. A day came when I could bear it no longer. I had to liberate at all costs the feeling it was stifling me. In order to reveal to all eyes what he was made of, I wanted to break open the handsome wax figure I presented everywhere. But the sea is rising. Seems to me, it won't be long before our boat leaves. The day is ending. Oh, look, the doves have gathered out there. They're crowding against one another, hardly stirring, and the light is waning. Don't you think we should keep silent to enjoy this rather sinister moment? Now, you're interested. You're very polite. But before explaining myself on the subject of Judge Penitent, I must talk to you of debauchery and of the little ease.
No, 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 you're wrong, my friend. The boat is going at full speed. But the Zuyder Zee is a dead sea, or almost. With its flat shores, lost in the fog, there's no knowing where it begins or ends. So we're steaming along without any landmark. We can't gauge our speed. We're making progress, and yet nothing is changing. It's not navigation, but dreaming. Let's sit down on these deck chairs. What a fog. I interrupted myself, I believe, on the way to the little ease. Yes, I'll tell you what I mean. After having struggled, after having exhausted all my insolent airs, discouraged by the uselessness of my efforts, I made up my mind to leave the society of men. No, no, I didn't look for a desert island. There are none left. I simply took refuge among women. As you know, they don't really condemn any weakness. They're more inclined to try to humiliate or disarm our strength. This is why woman is the reward, not of the warrior, but of the criminal. She's his harbour, his haven. It's in a woman's bed that he's generally arrested. Are they not all that remains to us of earthly paradise? I hesitate to admit it for fear of using a few more forbidden expressions, but it seems to me that at that time I felt the need of love. Obscene, isn't it? Inasmuch as I needed to love and be loved, I thought I was in love. In other words, I acted the fool. I often caught myself asking a question which, as a man of experience, I'd always previously avoided. I would hear myself asking, "Do you love me?" You know that it's customary to answer in such cases, "And do you?" If I answered yes, I found myself committed beyond my real feelings. If I dared to say no, I ran the risk of ceasing to be loved and would suffer as a result. But I lacked practice. For more than 30 years, I'd been in love with myself exclusively. What hope was there of losing such a habit? I didn't lose it and remained a trifler in passion. I multiplied the promises, contracted simultaneous loves. In this way, I accumulated misfortunes for others. As a result, I conceived such a loathing for love that for years I couldn't hear La Vioros or the Liebestod without gnashing my teeth. I tried accordingly to give up women in a certain way and live in a state of chastity. After all, their friendship ought to satisfy me. But this was tantamount to giving up gambling. Without desire, women bored me, and obviously I bored them too. No more gambling and no more theatre.
I was probably in the realm of truth. But truth is a colossal bore. Despairing of love and of chastity, I at last told myself that there was nothing left but debauchery. Lying late at night between two prostitutes, and drained of all desire, hope ceases to be a torture, you see. The mind dominates the whole past, and the pain of living is forever over. Alcohol and women provided me, I admit, with the only solace of which I was worthy. I reveal this secret to you, cher ami. Don't be afraid to make use of it. And then you'll see that true debauchery is liberating because it creates no obligations. In it, you possess only yourself. Hence, it remains the favorite pastime of the great lovers of their own person. It is a jungle without past or future, above all, without any promise or any immediate penalty. But there, too, I encountered an obstacle in myself. This time it was my liver, and a fatigue so dreadful that it hasn't left me. One plays at being immortal, and after a few weeks one doesn't even know whether or not one can hang on until the next day. The sole benefit of that experience when I'd given up my nocturnal exploits was that life was less painful for me. The fatigue that was gnawing at my body has simultaneously eroded many raw points in me. Each excess decreases vitality, hence suffering. There's nothing frenzied about debauchery, contrary to what is thought. It is but a long sleep. I lived in a sort of fog, in which the laughter became so muffled that eventually I ceased to notice it. The indifference that had already filled so much of me now encountered no resistance and extended its sclerosis. No more emotions, an even temper, or rather no temper at all. I was still living on my work, although my reputation was seriously damaged by my flights of language and the regular exercise of my profession compromised by the disorder of my life. Yeah. Outside my profession, I saw but few people, painfully kept alive one or two exhausted liaisons. It even happened that I would spend purely friendly evenings without any element of desire, yet with this difference that, resigned to boredom, I scarcely listened to what was being said. I became a little fatter, and at last was able to believe that the crisis was over. Nothing remained but to grow older. One day, however, during a trip to which I was treating a friend without telling I was doing so to celebrate my cure, I was aboard an ocean liner, on the upper deck, of course. Suddenly, far out at sea, I perceived a black speck on the steel-grey ocean. I turned away at once, and my heart began to beat wildly. When I forced myself to look, the black speck had disappeared. I was on the point of shouting stupidly for help when suddenly I saw it again. It was one of those bits of debris that ships leave behind them. Yet I had not been able to endure watching it, for I had thought at once of a drowning person. Then I realized, calmly, just as you resign yourself to an idea the truth of which you've long known, that that cry, which had sounded over the Seine behind me years before, had never ceased. Carried by the river to the waters of the Channel, to travel throughout the world, across the limitless expanse of the ocean, and that it had waited for me there until the day I encountered it. I realized likewise that it would continue to await me on seas and rivers, everywhere, in short, where lies the bitter water of my baptism. Here too, by the way, aren't we on the water? On this flat, monotonous, interminable water whose limits are indistinguishable from those of the land? Is it credible that we shall ever reach Amsterdam? We shall never get out of this immense stoop of holy water. Listen, do you hear the cries of invisible gulls? If they're crying in our direction, to what are they calling us? But they're the same gulls that were crying over the Atlantic the day I realized once and for all that I was not cured, that I was still cornered, and that I had to make do with it as best I could. Ended the glorious life, but ended also the frenzy and the convulsions. I had to submit and admit my guilt. I had to live in the little ease. To be sure, you're not familiar with that dungeon cell that was called the Little Ease in the Middle Ages. More often than not, one was forgotten there for life. That cell had ingenious dimensions. It was not high enough to stand up in, nor yet wide enough to lie down in. One had to live on the diagonal. Sleep was a collapse, and waking a squatting. Mon cher, that was genius. And I'm weighing my words in that so simple invention. Can you imagine a frequenter of summits and upper decks in that cell? What? Eh? One could live in those cells and still be innocent? Improbable, highly improbable, or else my reasoning would collapse. That innocence should be reduced to living hunchbacked. We cannot assert the innocence of any one man, whereas we can state with certainty the guilt of all men. Every man testifies to the crime of all the others. That is my faith and my hope. You believe me, religions are on the wrong track the moment they start to moralize and fulminate commandments. God is not needed to create guilt or to punish. Our fellow men suffice aided by ourselves. You were speaking of the last judgment. Allow me to laugh respectfully. I shall wait for it resolutely, for I've known what's worse, the judgment of men. Well, God's sole usefulness would be to guarantee innocence, and I'm inclined to see religion rather as a huge laundering venture, as it was once, but briefly, for exactly 3 years, and it wasn't called religion. Since then, soap has been lacking. Our faces are dirty and we wipe one another's nose. All dunces, all punished. Let's all spit on one another and hurry to the little ease. Each tries to spit first, that's all. I'll tell you a big secret, monsieur. Don't wait for the last judgment. It takes place every day. It's nothing. I'm merely shivering a little in this damned humidity. We're landing anyway. Oh, here we are. After you. But stay a little, I beg you, and walk home with me. I haven't finished. I must go on. Continuing is what's hard. Say, do you know why he was crucified, the one you're perhaps thinking of at this moment? Well, there are heaps of reasons for that. There are always reasons for murdering a man. The real reason is that he knew he wasn't altogether innocent. If he didn't bear the weight of the crime he was accused of, he'd committed others, even though he didn't know which ones. Did he really not know them? He was at the source, after all. He must have heard of a certain slaughter of the innocents. The children of Judea, massacred while his parents were taking him to a safe place. Why did they die, if not because of him? Those blood-spattered soldiers, those infants cut in two, filled him with horror. But given the man he was, I'm sure he could not forget them. As for that sadness that can be felt in his every act, wasn't it the incurable melancholy of a man who heard night after night the voice of Rachel weeping for her children and refusing all comfort? The lamentation would rend the night. Rachel would call her children who'd been killed for him, and he was still alive. Knowing what he knew, familiar with everything about man, ah, who would have believed that crime consists less in making others die than in not dying oneself? Brought face to face, day and night, with his innocent crimes, he found it too hard for him to hold on and continue. It was better to have done with it, not to defend himself, to die in order not to be the only one to live, and to go elsewhere where perhaps he would be upheld. He was not upheld. He complained, and as a last straw, he was censured. Yes, it was the third evangelist, I believe, who first suppressed his complaint. Why hast thou forsaken me? Oh, he was a seditious crow, wasn't he? Well then, the scissors. Mind you, if Luke had suppressed nothing, the matter would hardly have been noticed. In any case, he wouldn't have assumed such importance. Oh yes, one can wage war in this world. Ape, love, torture one's fellow men, or merely say evil of one's neighbour while knitting. But in certain cases, carrying on, merely continuing, is superhuman. He was not superhuman, you can take my word for it. He cried aloud in his agony, and that's why I love him. My friend who died without knowing. The unfortunate thing is that he left us alone to carry on whatever happens, even when we're lodged in the Little Ease, knowing in turn what he knew, but incapable of doing what he did, and dying like him. People naturally tried to get some help from his death. Why, a few streets from here, there's a museum called Our Lord in the Attic. The Dutch at that time put their catacombs in an attic. The cellars are flooded here. But today, I set your mind at rest, their Lord is neither in the attic nor in the cellar. They've hoisted him onto a judge's bench in the secret of their hearts, and they smite. Above all they judge in his name. He spoke softly to the adulteress, "Neither do I condemn thee." But that doesn't matter. They condemn without absolving anyone. Over the dead body of innocence the judges swarm, the judges of all species. Those of Christ, those of the Antichrist, those were the same anyway, reconciled in the Little Ease. For we mustn't blame everything exclusively on the Christians. The others are involved too. Wherefore, since we're all judges, we are all guilty before one another. All Christs in a cheap way. One by one, crucified, always without knowing. We should be, at least, if I, Clemence, had not found a way out. The only solution, truth, at last. No, I'm stopping, cher ami, fear nothing. Besides, I'm going to leave you, for we're at my door. In solitude and when fatigued, one is inclined, after all, to take oneself for a prophet. I am the end and the beginning. I announced the law. In short, I am a judge penitent. Yes, I'll tell you tomorrow what this noble profession consists of. You're leaving the day after tomorrow, so we're in a hurry. Come to my place, will you? Ring three times. You're going back to Paris. Oh, Paris is a long way off. Paris is beautiful. I haven't forgotten it. I remember its twilights at this same season, more or less. Evening falls, dry and rasping over the roofs, blue with smoke, the city rumbles, the river seems to flow backward. Then I used to wander in the streets. They wander likewise, now I know, they wander, pretending to hasten towards the tired wife, the strict home. Ah, mon ami, do you know what the solitary creature is like as he wanders in big cities. I'm embarrassed to be in bed when you come. It's nothing, just a little fever that I'm treating with gin. But I'm accustomed to these attacks. Now, sit down, please. You're examining this room. Bare, to be sure, but clean. A Vermeer painting without furniture or copper pots, without books either, for I gave up reading some time ago. No more books, no more useless objects either. The bare necessities, clean and polished like a coffin. And these Dutch beds so hard with their immaculate sheets, one dies in them as if already wrapped in a shroud, embalmed in purity. Oh, did you close the door thoroughly? Yeah? Oh, make sure, please. Forgive me, I have the bolt complex. On the point of going to sleep, I can never remember whether or not I've shot the bolt. And every day I must get up to make sure. Oh, don't think that this worry about the bolt is the reaction of a frightened householder. I'm eager to block the door of the closed little universe of which I am the king, the Pope, and the judge. Oh, by the way, will you please open that cupboard? Yes. Yeah, look at that painting. Don't you recognize it? It's the Just Judges. Yeah. If you read the papers, you'll recall the theft in 1934 from the Saint-Bavon Cathedral at Gand of one of the panels of the famous von Eyck altarpiece, The Adoration of the Lamb. That panel was called The Just Judges. It represents judges on horseback coming to adore the sacred lamb. It was replaced by an excellent copy, for the original was never found. Well, here it is. No, I had nothing to do with it. A frequenter of the Mexico City, you had a glimpse of him the other evening, sold it to the gorilla for a bottle. I first advised our friend to hang it in a place of honour. And for a long time, while they were being looked for throughout the world, our devout judges sat enthroned at the Mexico City above the drunkards and the pimps. Then the gorilla, at my request, put it in custody here. At the Mexico City above the bar, you saw the blank space they left. Why did I not return the panel? You have a policeman's reflex, you do. First, because it belongs not to me, but to the proprietor of the Mexico City, who deserves it as much as the Archbishop of Gand. Secondly, because among all those who filed past the Adoration of the Lamb, no one could distinguish the copy from the original, and hence no one is wronged by my misconduct. Thirdly, because in this way I dominate. Yeah. False judges are held up to the world's admiration, and I alone know the true ones. Fourth, because I thus have a chance of being sent to prison. An attractive idea, in a way. Fifth, because those judges are on their way to meet the lamb, because there is no lamb or innocence any longer. And finally, because this way everything is in harmony, justice being separated once and for all from innocence, the latter on the cross and the former in the cupboard, I have the way clear to work according to my convictions. With a clear conscience, I can practice the difficult profession of Judge Penitent. And since you're leaving, it's time now for me to tell you what it is. Allow me to first sit up so that I can breathe more easily. How weak I am. Lock up my judges, please. As for the profession of judge penitent, I'm practicing it at present. Ordinarily, my offices are at the Mexico City, but real vacations are carried beyond the place of work, even in bed, even with a fever. I'm functioning. Now, my words have a purpose. They have a purpose, obviously, of silencing the laughter, of avoiding judgment personally, though there is apparently no escape. Is that the great thing that stands in the way of our escaping it, the fact that we are the first to condemn ourselves? Therefore, it's essential to begin by extending the condemnation to all. No excuses, ever, for anyone. I deny the good intention, the respectable mistake, the indiscretion, the extenuating circumstance. With me, there's no giving of absolution or blessing. Everything's simply totted up, and then it comes to so much. You're an evildoer, a satyr, a congenital liar, a homosexual, an artist, etc., etc. Just like that. At the end of all freedom is a court sentence. That's why freedom's too heavy to bear, especially when you're down with a fever or are distressed. Or love nobody. Mon cher, for anyone who is alone, without God and without a master, the weight of days is dreadful. Hence one must choose a master, God being out of fashion. On the bridges of Paris, I, too, learned that I was afraid of freedom. In short, you see, the essential is to cease being free and to obey, in repentance, a greater rogue than oneself. When we're all guilty, that will be democracy. All together at last, but on our knees and heads bowed. That is why, très cher, after having solemnly paid my respects to freedom, I decided privately that it had to be handed over without delay to anyone who comes along. And every time I can, I preach in my church of the Mexico City. I invite the good people to submit to authority and humbly to solicit the comforts of slavery, even if I have to present it as true freedom. But I am not being crazy. I'm well aware that slavery is not immediately realizable. It'll be one of the blessings of the future, that's all. In the meantime, I must get along with the present. Hence, I had to find another means of extending judgment to everybody in order to make it weigh less heavily on my shoulders. I found the means. Open the window. A little, please. Oh, it's frightfully hot. No, not too much. I'm cold as well. My idea is both simple and fertile. How to get everyone involved in order to have the right to sit calmly on the outside myself. I discovered that inasmuch as every judge someday ends up as a penitent, when I had to travel the road in the opposite direction and practice the profession of penitent to be able to end up as a judge. Do you follow me? Good. But to make myself even clearer, I'll tell you how I operate. I set up my office in a bar in the sailor's quarter. The clientele of the port is varied. I've been practicing my useful profession at the Mexico City for some time. It consists, to begin with, as you know from experience, in indulging in public confession as often as possible. I choose the features we have in common, the experiences we've all endured, the feelings we share. The man of the moment, in fact, as is in me and the others. With all that, I construct a portrait which is the image of all and of no one. When the portrait's finished, as it is this evening, I show it with great sorrow. This, alas, is what I am. The prosecutor's charge is finished. But at the same time, the portrait I hold out to my contemporaries becomes a mirror. The more I accuse myself, the more I have the right to judge you. Even better, I provoke you into judging yourself. Admit that today you feel less pleased with yourself than you felt 5 days ago. Oh, no, it's snowing. Oh, I must go out. Amsterdam, asleep in the white night. The dark jade canals under the little snow-covered bridges. The empty streets, my muffled steps. It'll be purity, even if fleeting, before tomorrow's mud. See the huge flakes drifting against the window panes. Must be the doves, surely. They finally make up their minds to come down. The little dears, they're covering the waters and the roofs with a thick layer of feathers. They're fluttering at every window. What an invasion. Let's hope they're bringing good news. Everyone will be saved, eh? And not only the elect. Possessions and hardships will be shared. And you, for example, from today on, you will sleep every night on the ground for me. The whole shooting match, eh? Come now. Admit you'd be flabbergasted if a chariot came down from heaven to carry me off, or if the snow suddenly caught fire. You don't believe it? No more do I. But still, I must go out. All right, all right. I'll be quiet. Now, don't get upset. Why, now you're going to talk to me about yourself. And I shall find out whether or not one of the objectives of my absorbing confession is achieved. I always hope, in fact, that my interlocutor will be a policeman and that he'll arrest me for the theft of the just judges. You would arrest me then. That'd be a good beginning. Perhaps the rest would be taken care of subsequently. I'd be decapitated, for instance, and I'd have no more fear of death. I'd be saved. Above the gathered crowd, you'd hold up my still warm head so that they could recognize themselves in it, and I could again dominate. All would be consummated. I should have brought to a close, unseen and unknown, my career as a false prophet crying in the wilderness and refusing to come forth. But of course you're not a policeman. That'd be too easy. Huh? Ah, I suspected as much, you see. So that strange affection I felt for you had sense to it. You practice in Paris the noble profession of a lawyer. Hey, I sense we were of the same species. Are we not all alike, constantly talking and to no one, forever up against the same questions, although we know the answers in advance? Then tell me, please, what happened to you one night on the quays of the Seine, and how you managed never to risk your life? You yourself utter the words that for years have never ceased, echoing through my nights, and that I shall at last say through your mouth. Oh, young woman, throw yourself into the water again, so that I may a second time have the chance of saving both of us. A second time, eh? Oh, what a risky suggestion. Just suppose, cher maître, that we should be taken literally. We'd have to go through with it. Oh, the water's so cold. But let's not worry. It's too late now. It'll always be too late. fortunately.
You've been listening to The Fall, produced by H.B. Fortein and performed by Paul Schofield.